This is the Jewish News Podcast from jewishnews.co.uk. I'm Michael Daventry, and coming up on this programme, we compiled some of our coverage from the newspaper and website of events in Ukraine and their effects here in Britain. Where do we stand now on the war, on charity, and on sanctions? In a little while, we'll speak to Jonathan Boyd from the Institute of Jewish Policy Research about the Jewish demographics of Ukraine and Russia. To my colleague, Natalie Grivniak, who's in Ukraine right now and will give us an update on the situation there, and to my colleague Justin Cohen about the effects of the sanctions announced here in Britain in the past fortnight. Before that, though, over 3 million people have now fled the war in Ukraine, according to estimates from the United Nations, and it creates the urgent question of how to help them. In the last episode of this podcast, we heard about some of Israel's early efforts to resettle refugees. This week, the UK government outlined how it planned to help British people who were willing to host refugees in their own homes. What those don't address is how to help the people who are crossing the border right now. And one small initiative is underway thanks to the University Jewish Chaplaincy. Students have been flying out to Warsaw to help entertain children, to play with them, to give their parents valuable time simply to try to get their own lives in order. We spoke to two students out in Warsaw who told us what they saw. They're Isaac Benkomo from the London School of Economics, and before him you'll hear Nadia Goldman, a student from Birmingham.
Well, obviously it's a really, really tough and upsetting situation, and everyone we've learned have only been able to come with one bag, not even a backpack, just like a carrier bag, often wearing the same clothes. And that's actually something we saw at one of the refugee hotels. They had set up a shop. They just went, bought a load of things from Primark, and people came in and took everything from like socks to underwear. So it just shows how awful the experience is. These people just had to get up and leave without anything, and especially how tough it is on the children. And that's really why we're here, just to try and lift up their spirits, put a smile on their faces.
Since we are working with kids and children, there's also a need for supplies and activities to keep them entertained. I think it's also important to mention that these kids are coming from a traumatic experience, and it is very, very important to keep them entertained, keep them distracted. So anything from Legos to face paint are also essential, right? To keep them busy, to keep them away from or just distracted from the current situation. And I think that also builds resilience, right? Resilience in the kids. And it, just one more thing is, it's also important to mention that although we do have so many donations coming in, we would also like to call on people, if they have time to donate or their time to donate and contribute to these efforts, whether with us or with other agencies, it's also important that they do so.
The students are led by Rabbi Aaron Lemberger, a university chaplain from Scotland, who says they do not necessarily need equipment, but students with the energy and the time to devote to spending with children who've seen unspeakable horrors.
The main purpose of us being here is recognizing what we can give and what we can't. So we don't really deal with giving people supplies like clothes and stuff, because there's so many organizations that are doing it and are much better equipped to do it. And most of the donations are going there. And that is amazing. We didn't ask anyone to donate for us because we weren't sure that we could use it in the best way. And what we do have to do is, we have the energy and the time and the young people. We are dealing with kids, and we are young people that just want to come and work with the kids. So what we are asking is, people that can't come, yes, they should donate to the different organizations that are equipped to deal with donations and that would know how to take those donations and use them wisely. The main response we are getting again and again, and yesterday was the first day where we really worked with the children, and today we're going to go back there, and the main response is, please come. This is amazing. Kids didn't want us to go. While we were going, suddenly a kid came behind me and just hugged me. And I didn't even do anything. It's just because I'm wearing the same blue shirt as all the amazing students that were with her all the time.
You can follow the UJC's Ukraine delegation on Instagram. Just look up this handle at ujc.ukraine.delegation. We've been reporting a lot here at the Jewish News on the impact that the war in Ukraine has had on Jews in the region, not just in Ukraine, but in Russia too. But the Jewish communities in these two countries have been evolving and in many cases shrinking over the last few decades, especially since the collapse of communism. The Institute of Jewish Policy Research has put out a short briefing on the Jewish populations in these two countries, and Jonathan Boyd is its executive director. Jonathan, it's theoretically a simple question to begin with, but actually quite complicated. How many Jews are there living in Ukraine and Russia?
Well, the reason why it's a difficult question is it depends on how you define who is and isn't Jewish. And actually, when you look at former communist countries, because of the policies towards religious groups in particular in the former Soviet Union, the definitions of who is and isn't Jewish are particularly complicated there. In the case of the Ukraine, the figures basically range from anywhere between about 45,000 and 200,000. And it totally depends on which definition we're using to count.
So the spectrum, as you, as the JPR, have put it out, sort of ranges between what you call a core Jewish population on the one hand, and that's sort of the narrowest figure that you've provided, that's the 45,000 that you've mentioned for Ukraine. And the broadest definition goes under the law of return, which is, I suppose we could call it one of Israel's definitions of what a Jew would be, and that's, you put that at 200,000. But there are more categories, aren't there? You're also talking about things like Jewish ancestry and people who aren't Jewish necessarily themselves, but may have Jewish ancestors.
Yeah, correct. So the way we work out our figures is by looking at the evidence that exists in different sources. So the core Jewish population figure is How many people self-identify as Jewish when asked in, for example, censuses or surveys? So those are people, say, if a question in a survey, for example, is what is your religion or what is your ethnicity, people will give the answer Jewish. And based on that sort of analysis, we get the figure 45,000. And actually, it's probably slightly lower than that because that's the figure for 2020. So it's probably about closer to 42,000 now, actually. But those are people who self-identify as Jewish. But there are plenty of people, particularly in former communist countries, who don't necessarily self-identify as Jewish, but have a Jewish parent, either mother or father. So they might, if they have a mother, they might be halakhically Jewish. If they have a Jewish father, then they're not halakhically Jewish, but nevertheless, you know, have that sort of close Jewish ancestry. So if we ask the question, how many people are there in Ukraine with at least one Jewish parent, that figure, based on the evidence that we have, is closer to 90,000. Then there's what we call the enlarged Jewish population, which is not just people who self-identify as Jewish, but anybody who lives with them. Right, so you can imagine a scenario where there's a self-identifying Jew who's married to a non-Jew who has children who may or may not be being brought up as Jewish. But if we include all of that family, which is what we call the enlarged Jewish population, then the figure in Ukraine is 140,000. The law of return definition, which is the broadest one that we tend to use, is based on, you know, how Israel would define those people who are eligible for Israeli citizenship. And that basically applies to anybody who has at least one Jewish grandparent and their immediate families. So again, you can imagine a scenario of somebody who has a Jewish grandparent who has largely been brought up in a non-Jewish environment and doesn't actually necessarily self-identify, and their children and their families would be eligible under the terms of law of return to Israeli citizenship. So a lot of people in that 200,000 figure are not actually really, by any normative definition, Jewish, but they have sufficient Jewish ancestry to be eligible for Israeli citizenship under the terms of that law. So within that 200,000 people, certainly if you're thinking about it from a British perspective, many of those people would not be, I guess, what people would normally categorize as Jewish, really, but they nevertheless have some ancestry and, you know, may possibly identify in some way, shape or form through that ancestry.
So we've been speaking to quite a few rabbis since the war broke out, rabbis who are based in Ukraine, some of them who've had to flee Ukraine because of the war. And quite a few of them had said the same thing about the kind of communities that they've worked with. And a lot of them are American rabbis who moved over there after the collapse of the Iron Curtain and the end of communism. And they were talking about communities that were steadily growing, as in not necessarily in an observance, being from keeping Shabbat kind of way, but more and more Ukrainians, they were saying, were beginning to rediscover their identities after so many decades of communism where it was, to put it mildly, discouraged. Your figures, on the other hand, point to a very significant downward trend in the number of Jews who are based both in Ukraine and Russia since the collapse of communism. Why would you say that is?
Well, I mean, the decline is absolutely clear. There's no question whatsoever about it, and it's driven by two factors. One is natural decline. So if you look at the kind of the age composition of the Ukrainian population, it is overwhelmingly old. And basic demographic rule, if more people are dying than being born, a population is going to decline. If the reverse is happening, it will grow. In Ukraine, it's very clear that naturally the population is declining. But there's also been a lot of out-migration from the former Soviet Union in general. So, you know, the figure from the last Soviet Union census in 1989 for how many Jews were living in Ukraine was 487,000. 487,300, I think. And now the figures we're getting are closer to 45,000, as I said. So, you know, essentially that means that the Jewish population of Ukraine has declined, partly as a result of natural decline and partly mainly actually as a result of out-migration by 91%. So there's no question whatsoever that the population is declining. There is, at the same time, a phenomenon of... And you see this kind of across former communist countries of people rediscovering their Jewish roots. You know, you can imagine a scenario of somebody who hasn't been brought up Jewish but has a Jewish parent or has a Jewish grandparent who, you know, have discovered an interest in their family ancestry and, you know, having had the possibility of practicing their Judaism restricted under the Soviet Union are now able to explore it. So that phenomenon is definitely happening. I think when you're working on the ground as a rabbi or as a community worker, you encounter those stories quite regularly. So you often kind of get an impression that this is happening a lot. When you look at the stats and get an empirical picture, you see something quite different. So both of those things can be true at the same time. But, you know, one is a subjective view and one is a much more objective empirical view.
And your figures also covered Russia and the four categories that you mentioned a couple of minutes ago about the core Jewish population, those with Jewish parents, the more enlarged population, and then Israel's definition of Jews. You broke down the Russian figures in that way as well. And is it fair to say that, broadly speaking, proportionally, it's the same as Ukraine, just two or three times larger?
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's a larger population. Historically, it was a larger population. And the reasons for the decline in Russia are exactly the same. You know, huge wave of migration, particularly in the 1990s, in the decade after the collapse of communism, that slowed down a little bit in the first couple of decades of the 21st century. But the age composition of the Russian Jewish population is very similar. And at the same time, that phenomenon of people rediscovering their Jewish roots is also happening there. So the dynamics actually in both countries are pretty similar. You know, it feels almost a little callous, really, to be talking about numbers and demography under the current situation. It's just, you know, it's so horrendous what's going on that, you know, the kind of the demographic story feels... You know, it almost feels like it's just unimportant in the bigger picture of what's going on.
Well, I'm joined now by Natalie Grivniak from Lviv at the moment, who's been reporting for the Jewish News over the last couple of weeks. Natalie, you heard the conversation there that I had with Jonathan, and you had an interesting point of view to bring forward about Judaism in Ukraine. I mean, you're 5% Jewish yourself, if I understand correctly. There is a sort of reawakening of identity in Ukraine, or there certainly has been since the collapse of communism there, hasn't there?
Well, I'm not sure whether it's 5% or less or more. I cannot be sure properly. And by the way, hi everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. Yes, during the Soviet times, pretty much all of the Jews were going into the secularism. They didn't show their Jewishness. Predominantly, that's the difference between Jews in the States, for instance, and in the post-Soviet countries. We have a different process. Most of the people were following some of the traditions or non-following traditions, but just knowing that they have Jewish origins, you know, under the Soviet regime. And only after the independence, after 1991, many started to become more following traditions, more religious. So that's why in Ukraine, it's hard to understand how many Jews there are, what kind of, like, to number people that can be called Jews. Because you can call Jews those that have family roots, and they can be called, like, on the mother's side, and they can be called Jews. And they can be secular Jews. They might not go to synagogue, they might not go to or follow Shabbat or anything of that matter. But they will be Jews by origin. Or there are also Jews, you know, that are following the traditions and can be called religious Jews. They're going to the synagogues and, you know, following all of the traditions that they need to follow. So that's kind of like a little different from Jewish communities around the world.
Yeah. Well, let's move away from the demographic side of things to how events are at the moment. So you're in Lviv, in the west of the country, which has seen less fighting, certainly, than the east and the northern and southern parts. But can you give us a summary? What's the situation like in Lviv right now? We're recording on a Thursday.
Well, Lviv became kind of like a safe haven for all of the refugees and all of the people trying to escape the horrors of war. They are flying, I'm not flying, because the skies are closed right now at the moment in Ukraine, but they are driving or using trains or using buses or even going by feet sometimes. I mean, just escaping all of those cities that are being constantly bombarded with rockets and missiles and artillery. There are right now approximately 200,000 people remained in Lviv, which is a lot for the town that has no capabilities of hosting so many people. And many are passing further, like more than, you know, up to a million people just passed further crossing the border, because Lviv is approximately 3 to 4 hours away from the border with Poland and 4 or 5 hours away from other borders like with Slovakia and you know, more than Hungary. And so basically Lviv became like a hub, for like a transit hub for people trying to evacuate the war.
So we've been speaking to quite a few rabbis since the war broke out, rabbis who were based in Ukraine, some of them who've had to flee Ukraine because of the war. And quite a few of them had said the same thing about the kind of communities that they've worked with. And a lot of them are American rabbis who moved over there after the collapse of the Iron Curtain and the end of communism. And they were talking about communities that were steadily growing, as in not necessarily in an observance, being from keeping Shabbat kind of way, but more and more Ukrainians, they were saying, were beginning to rediscover their identities after so many decades of communism, where it was, to put it mildly, discouraged. Your figures, on the other hand, point to a very significant downward trend in the number of Jews who are based both in Ukraine and Russia since the collapse of communism. Why would you say that is?
Yes, it was quite an interesting person, and I'm sad that I didn't meet him, by the way, in person. I've been talking with his an acquaintance, a friend, the head of the Hilo of Kharkiv, and also I've talked with his girlfriend, and from what I have heard from her and from that other lady, I mean, he was a very open, kind person, very communicable, because he was a manager of the bar, so they needs to be very communicative, like very outspoken. But he wasn't really even looking like a Jew, as far as a stereotypical form of Jew should be looking like. He had he had the different tattoos of Scandinavian tattoos, and you know, he was quite open and free. He was free from the sin, as people were telling me, and he was definitely not willing to fight. He never thought of going to fight, but as soon As soon as he saw that the escalation is happening, he immediately, started to be involved with it, going to territorial defense and then further to the Ukrainian armed forces. And for me, that's very respectable, because I see that a lot of men that are trying to escape, they cannot leave the country because of the martial law, but they're trying to hide somewhere in the western regions. But those who come back and remain and try to defend their cities and try to defend their families or the people around them, for me, I pay tremendous respect to those people. And also I understand where he was coming from, because his mom is in Russia. He had some political disagreements with her, even though they're one family. And that's a big issue here, because Ukraine and Russia are very interconnected in the form of family ties or friend ties, due to the history, due to the Soviet times when displacements of people were happening specifically by the head of the Soviet regime, in order to minimize this kind of patriotic or local patriotic roots that could have been involved, because they were afraid exactly of that, so that the Soviet regime would collapse, under different nationalities. So they tried to mix people up, and that's the reason there are a lot of ties between the countries as well. But unfortunately, I understand where he's coming from. Unfortunately, to his story, his mom still is blaming, Ukrainian nationalists, even though I was actually shocked to hear one comment from the head of the Hillel, Kharkiv Hillel. She's saying that she thinks that she understands, mom of Serafim understands that it wasn't, nationalists shooting their own people. But for her, it's so hard to comprehend that and to understand that maybe they were wrong, and maybe she was wrong for so much time. And I think that's kind of the reality for a lot of Russians, for them to understand that for many years they don't want to feel that they've been fooled, or they are fooled by anyone, and that they might let everything, like whatever happens right now, they might have led to that, by choosing to support or not speaking if something has happened throughout the past couple of years, being ignorant or being just looking on the basic stuff like food, entertainment and stuff like this, and not thinking further of what can it lead to. So for me, it was kind of a strong interview, a strong sense of what I have been hearing from people.
It's a heartbreaking story for a family to be torn apart in that way. The tragedy speaks for itself. And I suppose moving from one tragedy to another in a country that's full of tragedies, you've written for us this week about the situation in Mariupol in the south of the country, which is under much heavier bombardment at the moment. And you've spoken to rabbis there. Can you tell us what the situation is there at the moment?
Well, the situation of Mariupol is definitely unique, because it's kind of like an iron curtain around the city. It's being fully attacked with all of the masses of Russian forces from the skies. Because why everyone in Ukraine is asking to close the skies? Because the biggest damages come from rockets, missiles, hits, bombs, the most damages, human damages, not infrastructural, military, or whatever they are telling. They're killing civilians, and sometimes they're killing it on purpose, and most of the times, I can say, and most of the times journalists as well, on purpose. I was also reporting about the other case, about Fox News crew that died. I can talk about that in the next question if you would be interested. But in Mariupol at the moment, it's just a complete humanitarian crisis. They do not have any provision, no water, no heat, heating system, no electricity. It 1 week ago it was -7 or -10, And for people to survive, they were heating up, you know, they just took snow and were melting it down in order to have some water to use. Or they were cooking on the streets and they were uniting with, you know, neighbors just cook on the streets. It was a total genocide of people. And in Mariupol, if we are right now talking and in a Jewish podcast, in Mariupol, there's a huge Jewish population. I think almost 90,000 people. That's a lot. Mariupol indeed is a very big city in the eastern part of the country. I think it's the ninth biggest city in Ukraine. So with a population of almost 400,000 people, something like this. So can you imagine how many people got trapped in this awful parallel reality where people don't know even how many dead ones are there. Official numbers are not proper because there are a lot of bodies that are still under debris, under the remains of houses. There are still, you know, there's still no understanding how many people died in Mariupol.
And listeners will remember, of course, for those who have found it difficult to keep a track of this protracted conflict, that Mariupol was also the town where the maternity hospital was struck about a week or so ago before we started recording this. And the fighting still goes on there. Natalie, I'm going to have to ask you to be brief on this last question, but I suppose it follows on from the situation in places like Kharkiv and Mariupol. What's your sense of the fighting now? Do you have this sense of inevitability that at some stage or another the cities will fall and Ukraine will be a Russian-controlled country, or do you feel differently?
I feel huge respect for Ukrainians. I feel huge respect for Ukrainian army and the way it is defending their territories. I think it's going to be really hard for Russians to take over Ukraine and those cities because the amount of strength and resistance Ukrainians are putting in it, I'm in awe. I'm in total respect of not only army but civilians as well. How people are uniting voluntarily, you know, supporting the army, supporting refugees, supporting, you know, building, you know, structures, organizational structures that could support each other. It's going to be really hard to attack and to conquer such unity and such resistance. It's going to be almost impossible. And plus, according to a lot of information from the experts, which I also interview quite often, you know, it's almost like 90% of the army that could be eligible to go into Ukraine were used. So destruction can come right now from rockets, and that's why Ukraine is just demanding the whole world, you know, any kind of protection from the air missiles, because that's that's what we need. On the field, you know, Ukrainians are quite, you know, quite good and in defending themselves, but from the air, it's really hard.
Natalie Grivniak, a Jewish News contributor in Lviv at the moment. Thank you very much for your time. We hope we'll be speaking to you again. Look after yourself.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Well, I'm joined now for the second time in a fortnight by Justin Cohen, the news editor and publisher of The Jewish News. And Justin, we had a conversation very similar to this in the last edition of the podcast a couple of weeks ago. But at that stage, there hadn't been the sanctions that we now are aware of. The most headline-grabbing of them all has been the sanction on Roman Abramovich, which has seen a sweeping number of measures on property, including Chelsea FC here in the UK. It's a remarkable development, isn't it, whichever way you look at it?
Of course it is. Roman Abramovich's involvement in British society went well beyond Chelsea Football Club. Of course, that was the most newsworthy part of his contribution, was the way he entered the scene of the UK, but he's actually used Chelsea as a vehicle for all sorts of charitable purposes, both inside and outside the community. And so the impact of these sanctions will be sweeping well beyond who owns the club next.
So let's talk about the impact of the sanctions on the Jewish community here in the UK. There were a large number of charitable sources, a lot of very positive charitable organisations, trusts, funding things as broadly, as ranges as broadly as, for instance, Holocaust awareness and education. A lot of those are likely to be affected, aren't they, by the sanctions regime?
They are. And the extent of that impact is yet to be discovered. But the total level of support from Russian oligarchs, from supporters of the community within the Russian community is extensive, and spans many different organisations. Three of the individuals that were sanctioned this week were trustees of the Genesis Philanthropy Group, and this received a lot of attention within the community. I think we need to separate out a few elements of this story. So, first of all, there is a tendency among some people at the moment to assume that if something is funded by Russians, regardless of their connection, there's a problem. I think we need to be careful to separate that out. Second of all, I think on the issue of the genesis, pardon the expression, of monies. I think that's well above an area that I know in great detail, and I think we have to rely on the government to come up with its decisions in that regard. Now that they have done in relation to certain individuals, obviously you would imagine that every communal organisation will totally and fully comply with the law. That goes without saying. At the same time, I think it's important that the community doesn't forget the fact that some of these individuals have contributed hugely to the community and improving community infrastructure, improving community provision over a very short space of time. And I think it's almost becoming taboo to even say that. But I think it's important that we do recognise that fact. Whilst, of course, as I say, following the law, as you'd expect anyone to do in these circumstances.
One of the impacts, you've already mentioned it there, is the fact that there were a lot of sources, a lot of them Russian, that were contributing hugely to the community in many different ways. That's going to leave a black hole, isn't it, in many Jewish organisations. So presumably we may be in a position where we'll see projects unfunded, buildings unbuilt, and a lot of other projects that will simply not be completed.
I'm not sure if we're talking about buildings being unbuilt, but certainly Genesis tended to focus on particular projects and getting new projects off the ground to engage young people in particular. And absolutely, if that funding isn't in place, I would imagine it's going to be quite hard to come by from other sources. I think we also might see, just like we had with the COVID period, that there are a small number of UK Jewish supporters that are approached to fill these gaps. And coming so soon after that COVID period, where they were relied on very, very heavily, this is going to be another huge further blow.
So, Justin, we talked there about the large contribution that came from a lot of Russian sources, large charitable contributions that were coming up until now and will be stopped because of this new sanctions regime that's been brought in place by the British government in concert with the European Union and the United States. The Genesis Philanthropy Group is a significant part of that. It's fair to say, isn't it, that there are a lot of projects that are simply going to be unfunded. There's going to be a large black hole in a lot of Jewish community organisations and projects, not least the Jewish News, which was funded by Genesis Philanthropy Group for a number of projects, including this podcast.
Yeah, as you say, a number of projects over the years, things like our Night of Heroes dinner was partly supported by Genesis and other projects as well. To be honest, I found Genesis to be almost become the go-to place for for anyone in the community that wanted to do something innovative for younger people in particular. They were, you know, often a source that people would go to for support. The problem we now have here is that this comes so soon after COVID, when a lot of the key Jewish families within the UK, when a lot of UK Jewish families who support the community were tapped for extra funds to plug gaps caused by COVID, they're now likely to receive calls galore to do this over again. And unfortunately, I suspect that some projects simply will not recover from this.
It's something we're going to have to keep watching over the next weeks and months as a sideshow to the gruesome events that are going on in Ukraine. But for the moment, Justin Cohen, the news editor and publisher of the Jewish News, thank you for your time. That's it from the Jewish News podcast from jewishnews.co.uk. My thanks to my guests from Ukraine and here in London, to Adam Bradley and Leo Mendel for their work in post-production, and to you for listening. Please do subscribe to the show in your podcast app. That way, you'll hear any previous episode or be informed when new episodes become available. And don't forget that for more information on any of the stories we've featured, you can visit us on our website. And if you'd like to comment, then we'd love to hear from you on editorial@jewishnews.co.uk. But from me, Michael Daventry, do join us next time here on the Jewish News Podcast. Goodbye.